Great to see everybody here this morning. Sitting with my cousin and her mom. She's all the way in from California. So, I was telling my boys we had breakfast a couple days ago, and she says, it gets hot in California, but we don't have this humidity. So, and I'm thinking to myself, I wonder if they need pastors out in California. How many of you know who Jim Martz is? Anybody know who Jim Martz is? The baseball scout? We have a scout from the local area. His name is Jim Martz, and he's spoken here for Lunch Bunch. And my dad, it seems like every year that he would speak at Rotary, my dad would call me and say, hey, Jim Martz is going to speak. Do you want to go to Rotary with me? And so we go together, and he'd tell old stories about baseball players and baseball players that he had found. He found a lot of players that became big names, and even some that have made it into the Hall of Fame. But there was a seismic shift in baseball in about 2001, 2002. You know, up until that point, everybody kind of relied on these old scouts to kind of determine whether or not a prospect had the possibility of actually becoming a big league player. And they used to measure some unusual kinds of things. They would look at how handsome a player was, because they figured the more handsome the person, the more likely they were to succeed. And conversely, they looked at the girlfriend or wife of the baseball player and determined, based upon their impression of her beauty, as to whether or not the player had high or low self-esteem and self-confidence, and how that would affect whether or not they would become a player. They looked at the part of the country that they grew up in, and they measured things like the size of forearms and all this crazy stuff. They had all this crazy criteria that they would use to try and kind of discern who would make it and who wouldn't make it. But in 2001, the Oakland A's, which is a small market team, they got beat by the dastardly New York Yankees. Any of us who are Indians fans know all about the Yankees. Always crushing us. And so they were knocked out of the American League playoffs in 2001, and they lost their three best players to free agency because they were a small market team. They didn't have as much money as the large market teams. Like New York, they can pay millions and millions and millions of dollars for a proven player. Can't really do that in Cincinnati, can you? Cincinnati kind of suffers from this, and so it's kind of hard. It's harder if you have less money to put together a good team. And so a general manager by the name of Billy Beane, who had not quite made it as a baseball player himself, he hired a young man who was an economics major from Yale, who was working in the front office of the Cleveland Indians, and brought him out to Oakland. And they ended up revolutionizing baseball. Instead of all the things that the other scouts looked at to determine whether or not a player would be successful or not, instead, they use something called sabermetrics. I'll just let, from the movie Moneyball, I'll just let the actors explain it.
Peter Brand.
Billy.
How are you?
Hi, how you doing? Nice to see you.
Good to have you here. Well, you're moving fast.
Yeah, I got here early this morning.
Wow.
All moved in.
Yeah.
Hey, Billy. I wanted you to see these player evaluations that you asked me to do.
I asked you to do three.
Yeah.
To evaluate three players.
Yeah.
How many did you do?
47.
Okay.
Actually, 51. I don't know why I lied just then.
don't you walk me through the board?
Thank you. Equation in the upper left right here, I'm projecting that we need to win at least 99 games in order to make it to the postseason. We need to score at least 814 runs in order to win those games and allow no more than 645 runs.
What's this?
This is a code that I've written for our year-to-year projections. This is building in all the intelligence that we have to project players.
Okay.
It's about getting things down to one number. Using the stats the way we read them, we'll find value in players that nobody else can see. People are overlooked for a variety of biased reasons and perceived flaws. Age, appearance, personality. Bill James and mathematics cut straight through that. Of the 20,000 notable players for us to consider, I believe that there is a championship team of 25 people that we could afford, because everyone else in baseball undervalues them. Like an island of misfit toys.
So everybody sees the same thing. Everybody sees the same thing. But not everybody sees it the same way. Everybody sees the same people, but not everybody sees it the same way. In 2002, the Oakland A's cut their salary, lost their three most productive players, and ended up winning their division and going back to the AL Championship, where once again, they were beaten by the dastardly New York Yankees, who spent almost four times much more money than they did. And they have the same general manager, and they continue to be competitive year after year after year. And others follow their lead. It's how the Red Sox broke their 100-year curse. It's the way the Chicago Cubs finally won a World Series. They began to see people differently. Not what's the shape of their jawline or how handsome they are. But how often do they get on base? And can they get people out? And it didn't matter what they looked like, how big or how small or whatever. To me, that's a good understanding of discernment. That's a good way of thinking about it. It's to see the same thing that everybody else sees, but to see it in a different way. To see others, we all see one another. We all see other people. But the question is how do you see them? Do you just follow the crowd and see them the same way everybody else, prevailing wisdom does, or do you look at them differently? This summer we've been going through a bunch of Old Testament characters most of you have never heard of. Balaam's one of them. Balaam's kind of a weird dude. He is not a prophet of Israel. As a matter of fact, he's not an Israelite. He's someone who already lives in the promised land, and he's just recognized as someone who's spiritual, or a spiritual leader, or some sort of priest. We've seen the same thing. If you were in my Bible study a couple of years ago, when we were talking about Abraham and Sodom and Gomorrah, you know, we saw the same thing in a figure in the Bible in the 14th chapter of Genesis named Melchizedek. And Melchizedek was a priest. He was described as a priest, but not with Israel. Just another holy person. You kind of get these people. They kind of crop up in the Old Testament. The witch of Endor, who Saul consults in order to try and understand whether or not he's going to be king much longer or not. He's not. But we have these figures in the Old Testament especially. And so Balaam's one of these folks. He's considered a spiritualist, a priest, a witch doctor. He's considered someone that has a kind of a sense of the spiritual. And so as Israel crosses over Jordan and begins to take the promised land after 40 years wandering in the desert after being delivered from Egypt by Moses, as they cross over the Jordan and they begin to take the promised land back from themselves, from the people who were living there, after they had won a couple of battles and had vanquished a couple of different tribes, nations, there were others that got together out of fear and decided that they needed to do something to try and stop their progress. So it was a group of people that were led, a group of leaders led by a man named Balak, and they went to Balaam, and what they wanted him to do was they wanted him to go to a high place, because there were no temples in that part of the world at that particular time in history. There are no temples. When you worship God, you go up to a high place and you make an altar, and then you offer a sacrifice to that God, whatever God it is, whoever it was in that world that you worshipped. And these strange Israelites had this God that you couldn't see him. There were no idols that they wore, and this strange group, but he seemed to be pretty powerful. And so what they wanted was they wanted Balaam, the spiritual guy, to go up on a high place, offer up a sacrifice, and then proclaim a curse on Israel so that they could be defeated. And I don't know if you've heard or not, but there are some people who are involved in institutional religion, or maybe not even institutional religion, who consider themselves to be spiritual people, who often are just in it for the money. I don't know if you heard that or not, but let us happen once or twice in history. And so it does not appear to be beyond Balaam's normal way of doing things. It's not beyond him to just take the money and do whatever they ask. But then he goes to sleep, has a dream. God speaks to him in the dream and says, "Don't go." So he wakes up the next day, tells Balak, "I'm not going. I'm not going to go." Balak says, "You got to go." Balaam goes back, has another dream. God says, "You can go, but you can only say what I tell you to say. Whatever they're paying you to say, You can't, unless I tell you it's okay, you can't say it." And so Balaam says, "All right." So they leave the next day, and Balaam's on his trusty donkey. And in the story, there appears to be a relationship, a strong master-servant, owner, a beast of burden relationship between Balaam and his donkey. I'm certain that in times past, the donkey, as he carried Balaam walking on some sort of small path, would stop, because even though Balaam couldn't see the viper that was ready to strike, the donkey could. As they were progressing forward, the donkey began to back up, because the donkey could, with his little donkey sense, could sense the pack of wolves that were coyotes that were about to attack, or that there was some weak part from rain on the side of a mountain on the path that was ready to give way, and the donkey could tell by the footing that it wasn't safe. And so there's this implied relationship that Balaam trusts this beast of burden. And so They're headed out, and all of a sudden, donkey stops. And Balaam gets ticked. Instead of just trusting the fact that this beast that had always had his best interest and its own in mind could sense something that he couldn't, instead he begins to beat it. And this happens a number of times until finally the donkey speaks. I don't know how many of you have a pet. What would happen if you were sitting in your chair with your pet and your pet spoke to you? I could just see Albert sitting in the recliner with me, looking up and saying, "You're not in very good shape. I'm worried about your cardiovascular health. I also presently need to use the bathroom, so how about you get the leash and we go for a walk?" If the dog spoke to me, I would do one of two things. I would just go ahead and take him for a walk, or I would check myself into a mental hospital. But Balaam's ass speaks. I've been wanting to say that in a sermon for 20-some-odd years. Balaam's ass speaks, and I'll sum it up by saying this. He says, "Why are you beating me? I have never let you down before. Why are you beating me right now?" And Balaam sees what everybody else can see. But he's not seeing it in a... He can see the lucrative opportunity with Balak and the heads of the other tribes and nations that are opposed to Israel. He can even see the danger of Israel. He can also see, to some degree, the power of the living God. But it's inferred that Balaam's going to go do what Balaam was going to do in the beginning, and that was go take the money and run. But then he can see the angel of the Lord. And the rest of the story goes like this. So Balaam, the angel, permits Balaam to go forward. They go to a high place. They make an altar. Balak and the others say, "Okay, go ahead and curse Israel." And he says what God has to say to him, and he blesses Israel. Blesses Israel. Balak and the other people are furious. So they go to another high place where they can see Israel down in the valley. And once again, they build more altars and they give more sacrifices. And once again, Balaam, instead of cursing Israel, says what God would have him to say, and he blesses Israel again. And this happens for a third time, and then they attempt a fourth time, and instead of blessing Israel, Balaam begins to prophesy the destruction of the very tribes and nations that have hired him to curse Israel. He begins to prophesy their destruction. They finally give up and they let him go back home. Discernment is seeing not what everybody else sees in the same way that they see it. Balaam's donkey could see something that Balaam could not. And Balaam, in turn, because God had appeared, Balaam began to look at the world differently and acted differently than you would have expected. And that's the way that discernment works. Discernment, instead of us just simply accepting whatever the conventional wisdom is, to see beyond that and try to look at people the way that God looks at people. I mean, Jesus did this all the time, right? Jesus did it over and over. Jesus, who becomes the king of this kingdom, where his apostle Paul described it as a kingdom without male or female, or Jew or Gentile, or slave or free, or rich or poor. This new kind of community that's not built on these narrow affinities, but rather something different. Now, in the Old Testament, God had raised up the Tower of Babel And there was this season where people were different, and they were different and acted different and believed different, so that Israel could be lifted up and people could see what this one true God was doing through this one group of people. But after Jesus ascends into heaven and the Holy Spirit descends upon His followers in the court of the Gentiles in the temple of Jerusalem, they begin to speak all of the different languages of the world, which signifies to anybody who knows anything about the Old and the New Testament that this season that had begun with the Tower of Babel that was built around difference was now closed. And now we're looking at this new kingdom with every tribe and every nation and every people and every language, a phrase that's used 9 times in the book of the Revelation. An empire, a kingdom that's not built on power or violence, of revenge, but that's supposed to stop with the cross. That's where death is supposed to end. That's where hatred is supposed to end. That's where something new is supposed to begin. And so while we might frame and understand what discernment looked like in the Old Testament, maybe a little differently in the New, the one thing where it is unified is this idea that it's to see others the way God sees others, and to try and look past the way most people are looking at things, and instead try to see others the way that God sees them. This was we just celebrated the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11, and it's a big deal in this part of the world because old Neil Armstrong, right? Neil Armstrong, just a kid from Wapak, who got to be the first man on the moon. And I think it's really interesting, in any interview you ever read with Neil Armstrong about that experience, and there are not many, because he didn't talk much about it, did he? In any interview that you read about him, he downplays his role in that endeavor. He makes it clear that he was just a part of a larger group of people that were given something that sounded impossible, a human being walking on the surface of the moon. And instead of just thinking about that in poetic or romantic terms or in terms of legend or story, they saw it as a challenge. And with every experiment, with every different mathematician or scientist or astronaut or technician or whoever's talents were contributed to this effort, and through each test mission where they learned just a little bit more of what it meant to actually send somebody out into space, that he was simply the culmination of a large group of people who just saw things differently. He did not want to be mistaken as the person who walked on the moon, but rather one of many who saw this opportunity where other people just saw impediment. Discernment, looking past the way others see each other. There was another anniversary that was celebrated this week. It was less celebrated. It was the 10-year anniversary of our former president, Jimmy Carter. And it was the 10th anniversary of him withdrawing his membership from the Southern Baptist Church. Jimmy Carter, if you don't know, he attends the Southern Baptist Church in Plains, Georgia. He has a Sunday school class every weekend that he feels up to it. He's battling cancer now. He's in his 90s. But every weekend that he's up to it, he teaches a Sunday school class just as he did before he was president, and even before he was governor of the state of Georgia, he teaches a Sunday school class. And in the Southern Baptist bylaws, it would be considered pretty near impossible for a non-member to teach a Sunday school class in their church. But But Jimmy Carter, even though he's no longer a Southern Baptist, continues to do so. He's there. He probably taught just a little bit earlier this morning. And the reason why he withdrew his membership was he was asked by Nelson Mandela. And Mandela was kind of at the point of the spear of the effort to end apartheid in South Africa. Paid a terrible, terrible price in the work that he did. Spent a number of years in prison, was physically abused. His family and friends were hounded. Some of them were even killed. He was perpetually intimidated. And so when finally apartheid ended and Mandela became president, it was just one of the most incredible stories in the history of modern history, in modern history. But Mandela at some point was no longer president. He was no longer a leader. He was too old. He was no longer interested in seeking public office. And so he reached out to former leaders of nations all over the world and asked them to come together as a part of a body he named the Elders. And since they didn't have to be reelected and they didn't have to worry about stock prices going up or down, or they were just at a point in their life where they could just speak whatever they thought the truth was and just lay it there. And you had to deal with it the way that you wanted to. He called Carter, among others, to be a part of this group called the Elders, and in their first meeting, what they decided to focus on was the way women were treated in the world, particularly in religious communities. And so when Jimmy Carter came back and he spoke about the limitations that often Christian churches like his own denomination, put on females, he decided to follow through with how he felt by withdrawing his membership from the Southern Baptist Church. That was 10 years ago. This subject still roils that denomination. He thought our denomination was the only one with problems. If you're a woman and you ever took a Bible study from a woman named Beth Moore, you'll know that right now Beth Moore is in a pitched battle with the Southern Baptist Church because there are people within it who want her to stop teaching because they think it's improper. Even though she's only ever advocated teaching to other women, she keeps getting asked by churches to come and speak to everybody. And there are some who think that that's a danger. So, Jimmy, this is not just something that, it's just something that continues. But while Carter was speaking to his own context, there were others of the elders that were speaking into other contexts around the world. Muslim leaders spoke into communities where the rights of women were severely inhibited or restricted. They spoke into places where it takes three women and their testimony to equal the testimony of one man. They spoke into Hindu contexts. They spoke into Roman Catholic contexts. They spoke all over the world. And they said, we need to see women differently than we're seeing them right now. It's discernment. It's discernment. It's looking and seeing what God sees when he looks at somebody else. Has there ever been like a teacher or maybe a boss or a manager you had at work or a college professor or somebody who saw something in you that you felt like nobody else could see and your life was impacted and changed because of it? I always like to tell the story about the one time I got bullied in my life. I was in the first grade and I got bullied by a kid in the fourth grade. His name was David. And my dad, my dad taught me how to fight. and told me that if I didn't fight back, that I'd get a more severe whooping when I got home than if I took one out at the school. And so I punched this kid in the stomach to get away from him. And the next day when I came around, he pulled a knife on me. Now, it was a butter knife. But I've told that story a lot of times. But I don't think I've ever told the story of what happened to David Bentley. He's a drug and alcohol counselor now in the Charleston area. He actually helped a friend of mine, her son, who had been wrapped up in addiction. He was actually one of the primary caregivers and counselors which have helped Christy's son put his life back together. And she kind of put us together back through David and I. She knew the story of David and I, and she kind of put us back together via social media. And I was just straight up with him. I just said, I just figured by now you'd be in prison. And he said, I had this teacher in high school. Everybody else thought I was stupid, which is what my parents had told me I was all of my life. But this teacher saw something more. And it changed the direction that I was going, because whenever I heard these voices telling me I wasn't worth anything, I could hear this teacher's voice telling me that I was. See, I understand speaking out into the world where we see sin and confronting sin. I get that. But we're New Testament people. We're on the other side of the Pentecost, where everybody could speak in all the languages of the world. We're the ones who, when we went to VBS, they taught us songs like Jesus loves the little children, all the children of the world. You can sing with me if you want. Red and yellow, black and white, they are precious in His sight. Jesus loves the little children of the world. And we're supposed to take that to heart. Those who have the gift of discernment, the discernment of potential, the discernment of gifts and graces, the ability to be able to speak into someone else's life and help them see themselves the way God sees them, or to speak out into the world and say, I don't care what the prevailing wisdom is. This person or these people are sons and daughters of Jesus' Father, just like all the rest of us. And speak boldly the truth that loving our neighbor means that we want to be treated the way that we're going to treat others the way that we would want to be treated. That is a powerful, powerful, powerful gift. It changes lives, changes families, changes communities, and it changes the world. And every single one of you, from all of your varied backgrounds and everything that you've been through, if you don't feel like you have much to offer, I want you to know this morning that that is a lie. That is a lie straight from the pit of hell. You are all wonderfully and fearfully made, and you are loved abundantly by the living God, and you can be used. I've seen it again and again and again. You can be used in powerful ways. to be a blessing on God's behalf in the lives of others in this world. If you believe that about yourself, let it go. Just like Frozen, let it go. Let it go. Please don't sing anymore, Pastor Brian. But if you think you have this gift, if you sense that maybe there's somebody out there that you need to just speak a good word, someone you work with, could be a child and that comes over with your kids' friends in your house, I don't know, but if there's somebody that needs that encouraging word and you think, I don't know that my voice would make a difference, I want you to know that if you think that it doesn't, you're probably wrong. If God is leading you to speak hope into another person's life, don't walk to do it. Run. Because what this world suffers from more than anything else is not understanding how God sees it. And you can help in that. With a good word.